Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Welcome back to the NHAT podcast, sponsored by the Emmy White Chamber of Commerce. Today we're speaking with an amazing, amazing board member with the Emmy White Chamber of Commerce, Mr. George Veltzik. How are you doing today, sir?
I am doing well. That was that thunderous applause. It can't get any better.
So you are known for your intellect, all right? So I was told a lot of great things. Absolutely.
You got to tell me about this.
Okay, okay.
Because I've been called a lot of things.
A lot of things?
And intellect is not one of
them. Well, as a matter of fact, walking up here, someone actually was commenting on your beard game, too. So that was, so you must get a lot.
I get that a lot.
I get that a lot. All right, so I was told in reference to entrepreneurship and the psychodemographics of how racism makes a huge impact on our strides for better economic footing within the United States, right, and also getting that generational wealth, right? And how part of that comes into identity,
yes,
of how we identify each other,
yes,
but then also how really we identify ourselves.
Exactly.
So if you don't mind kind of sharing with the audience who may not be aware of that, because it's crazy, some people just aren't aware of that, yes, and the importance behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that was beautiful the way you said that. Identity to the human being is like software to the computer. It serves a purpose. And we don't think like that. You know, it's easier for us to see it in inanimate objects. But a lot of things that we work are really patterned off of how we work. You know, how our body works, how our brain works. And ideology is software. You know, you have political ideology, you've got spiritual, religious ideology. And then there's this thing called race ideology. And most people just aren't of the understanding that race is an ideology. It is not a genetic, scientifically backed, it's not even a valid concept.
Yep.
And because people don't understand that, they think that race is real. And race is not real, but the impact of the belief in race produces very real outcomes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was so long, not a long time ago, maybe sometime a couple years ago, I was talking to someone and I said, so-and-so is Caucasian, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And the person I was talking to was like, why would you say that? Like, you know, right, why not just say white? And I was like, well, you know, that doesn't really exist. That's really a part of a classism, you know, that was put here strategically, basically for economic empowerment for people who came from Europe, et cetera, et cetera.
Drop the mic on that one.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. America is the only place in the world that incorrectly uses the term Caucasian.
Hmm.
Caucasian refers to a geographical location.
Yeah.
And what America does is we use it to refer to people with white skin. But in reality, across the globe, there are many skin tones based on the region that fall under Caucasian.
I did not know that.
Including ours.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's the difference between a racial identity and a cultural identity. A cultural identity is generally associated with a geographic location.
Wow. So technically, someone else, you know, it could be our hue, could technically be Caucasian.
Yes.
Right?
There are people across the globe that, based on the region that Caucasia refers to, there are people across that span of geography that have different skin tones, different skin complexions.
Wow. So when you hear the word black, or when you see that on like a census, when they're collecting data, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm, what immediately comes to your mind?
That the game is rigged. The game is rigged. If you look on the census, you'll see that they have cultural groups that are allowed to check either the white box or the black box. And so if you're of a particular culture from Europe, generally, you're checking the white box, the white racial box. If you're a particular culture that is non-European in general, not in all cases, but in general, you're most likely relegated to check the black box. And that's all based for, as you said earlier, economic distribution, access, and wealth.
Absolutely. Can do you mind if we go a little deeper for those who may not understand how that plays a role within wealth distribution, mm-hmm. how it plays a role in lending, how it plays a role in commerce, et cetera, et cetera. So when we're talking about, like, so for example, if it's on a census and they're looking to decide what area that they're going to develop or not, right? What area they're going to put maybe even a railroad track. Mm-hmm. How does that data from the census impact the decisions that the government may or may not make?
So the Reader's Digest version of how this works is, first of all, race ideology is AKA white supremacy. Now, when I say white supremacy, it sounds like really accusatory and evil, and like I'm really saying white people bad. No, that's not what I'm saying.
Right.
White supremacy just refers to the social hierarchy. And in race ideology, it's an ideology designed for people who are allowed legally to be white, because white's a legal classification. Those who are allowed to be white come in at this level of the hierarchy. Those who are not allowed to be white come at a lower level of the hierarchy. So what systems like the census does is maintain that racial status quo. And that's the simple, most quickest version of that. They may portray it like, well, we're using the census in order to give the proper economic support and demographic support so that we know who's where. But that's really not what it's about. It's about maintaining the racial status quo. And you can look at it in any systemic area of service, whether it's finance, housing and loan, employment, health, public safety. You'll see that racial status quo being maintained in every one of those systemic areas of service. That's the real purpose of race ideology. It's not here to help us out.
So just for more history, something I love, I like history. So I'm always thinking like, why would someone do that? You know, mm-hmm. This is just from my perspective too.
Okay.
So I was wondering, you know, one day I was like, why would they invent various races? Right. What was the whole purpose of that?
Right.
And I was looking at, okay, well, if someone was fleeing from, quote unquote, a hierarchy, mm-hmm. Where you could not be a part of if you were born a peasant, you were going to die a peasant,
right.
Basically. Mm-hmm. And then when people came to the, quote unquote, Americas, they said, hey, we might have an opportunity to go ahead and do something different as we so choose, mm-hmm. right? But in order to make things work for an economy, there has to always be a quote unquote lower class.
Right.
And then to benefit the economy, you have to basically benefit or take, or in some cases, rape, pillage, et cetera, mm-hmm. a quote unquote lower class,
right.
and be justified in you doing such by saying, hey, you know, this is what God wants us to do.
Exactly.
And so fast forwarding to today, where I think more people are kind of seeing that the economic disparity isn't all, well, let me put it this way. There are some people that have the race qualification of white that still have the economic disparity.
Right.
And so more people are waking up and saying, hey, maybe we have more in common than I thought we did. Mm-hmm. Why don't we try to band together, et cetera, et cetera. What is your perspective on that awakening?
Yeah, so you covered a lot of ground there. The from the question of, first of all, why would someone even create this type? And the experience that you, the story that you told is the story of most every cultural civilization. They've had some type of struggle for dominance and ideology. And what happens in America is people will equate those struggles to that of race. Every cultural group has had some type of struggle in terms of how it's going to distribute and get along and create a system that they think is the best for their system. America, however, the European, is the only one credited with this particular brand of oppression. So, you know, the slavery exists all over the world.
Yeah, Yeah.
But we're speaking particularly with what's going on in the America. So we can't conflate other cultures' history of slavery with the Europeans' brand of slavery, which is very, very diabolical. It can't be compared to any other cultural group's experience, because the European is the only one that created slavery based on how a person looks. And they used the physical makeup of a person to determine their social value. And they then set out on a colonialist mission and conquered a lot of countries.
Yeah.
Passing on that belief system. And so you'll see one of the informative YouTube videos I recommend everybody to look at is titled How the European Divided Africa, Carved Up Africa. And it was the Berlin Conference, where all of the European countries got together in one place and made an agreement on how they were going to carve up Africa to utilize its resources for their economic benefit. And so slavery exists in any of those colonialized areas, from France, Spain, any of those European countries, but it looks different. So you come to present day, now people are coming to an awakening, but they don't have that knowledge, like what I've just given you. Most people aren't aware of the history, and they conflate slavery in general. And slavery in general is not what's going on here. This is an ideological battle we're dealing with. So you come with this awakening, but you don't have the knowledge. So even though you're awakened, you don't know what to do. You don't know the effective way to do it. And it goes right back to where you opened up with identity. So you come through this awakening, but you're still using the ideological identity that has been keeping you in the closet for so long.
Yeah.
So it's like you have this cognitive distance, like something's not right here, and I want to change it. But because you haven't changed the way you think, every effort you make to try to change it comes right back to white supremacy.
So how could someone listening to this, what steps could they take to change that identity?
First, this is what I teach. I call this, my platform is called Racial Deconstruction. And I named it Racial Deconstruction because race is a social construct. So theoretically speaking, anything that can be constructed can be
deconstructed.
Right. And that deconstruction process is a three-stage process. First stage is education. If you're not properly educated on race, you're going to be of no earthly benefit. Second part is self-reflection. This is the therapeutic component that I use, because that is my profession as a therapist. And I'm approaching this from a therapeutic model. That second stage is self-reflection, where you take a hard look at how you are participating in this ideology. When people look at issues of race and racism, they're always thinking it's the other guy. But there's a quote that I like to use. I can't think of the name of the guy, but it goes along with something of, we have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us.
Enemy is enemy.
Ooh, yes. So we're always looking, pointing our fingers at some. Well, they ought to stop doing it. They should stop doing it. Those evil, mean racists. That's not the problem. It's the everyday, morally based person who wants to do the right thing, who wants to treat people right, who wants to live to their Christian values, to their patriotic values, but find themselves still in this morass of chaos when it comes to race. So they don't know what to do. And then the third process, step in the process, is application. Actually changing the behaviors that contribute to it. We've been doing a DEI model, diversity, equity, inclusion model, which really only does, it doesn't really do any of those three steps. It thinks it does, but it doesn't. It actually confuses things more. And this is statistically supported. This is not an opinion. This is researched, valid statistics on the effectiveness or lack thereof of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the reason that DEI, the well-intended, fails is that it conflates culture with race. And so you're trying to address a culture issue where really it's a racial issue.
Correct, yeah.
And on top of that, the average DEI person is not educated about race. They like to think they are. And I try to, you know, I've been trying to approach the DEI community, but they're not really wanting to play nice with me because it's a $1 billion-a-year business.
It is.
They're doing very, very well, but their results aren't.
It's not showing.
Yeah. And what they don't understand now is because of the current state of our politics, that DEI is going to be phased out because they're using the agenda, the political agenda that is attacking DEI is using DEI's weakest link, which is their lack of education about what race is. So they're using a racial strategy to phase DEI out. And DEI professionals are not equipped to have a proactive and effective response to it. And it's at dangerous levels. DEI could be so much more powerful if they would just adopt this one component that I'm promoting, which is racial deconstruction. But they're going to have to be willing to say, hey, we don't know this area. We don't know this. And they have to look at the stats in their area. It's not working. Training, implicit bias training does not change behaviors.
Right.
Training does not change behaviors. Addressing the belief system behind behaviors changes behaviors.
The ideology that you mentioned earlier, it's kind of sad. Not kind of, it is sad. Because it reminds me of someone who is given shackles.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who gives you the shackles walks away.
Yeah.
They may even put the key in your hand.
I love it.
But because a person is so used to having the shackles on, mm-hmm. they participate. It kind of reminds me of the allegory of I don't know if it was Homer or Socrates or whatever, mm-hmm. of the allegory of the cave,
mm-hmm.
right? Where they have these guys they had, unfortunately, it didn't happen for real, everyone, but the allegory says that there are these people chained up. And they're looking at images of what they think is a real world, but they're shadows. So there's fire. It was firing behind them, and people are playing with puppets.
Yeah.
And people, anyway, these slaves or prisoners, they have to look at the cave walls.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, they unchain one of the prisoners
mm-hmm.
and allow that person to exit the cave. And this person who exits the cave, it's this person's first time seeing what a real flower looks like, what a real bird looks like. It's the first time that they're having the sunlight put into their eye, et cetera.
Mm.
And so what they end up doing is that one person, because they were so conditioned to being chained in a cave and having a fake reality, they become upset.
Yes.
They become so upset that they run back into the cave and they convince everyone else who's already chained up, hey, listen, what you have right here is good.
It doesn't get any better than that.
It doesn't get any better than this. You don't want to deal with a bee because it might sting you. You know, you don't want to deal with a bird because they're loud, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of the ideology where you tell people, hey, listen, you can be free.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be under that system. But they're like, well, I like the system.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the benefits that I get. I like being categorized as et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I like the stereotype mm-hmm. of being loud, or I like the stereotype of being angry, et cetera, et cetera. This serves me.
Yes.
But then politicians, when it's time for election season, they use those same stereotypes to say, hey, listen, you don't want that for you, right? You don't want that for yourself. Vote for me. I'll get you out of this cave. And then after election season's over, we find ourselves back into the same cave okay. with the same shackles and say, listen, this is good. You don't want this to get any better than this. It's dangerous out here. You don't want that. And that's what that reminds me of, the ideology, the chains.
Yeah. You just described my experience in promoting this different paradigm of thought. More people, unfortunately, than not respond the way that you just expressed. They will hear the truth. In one of my workbooks that I put together that I use in my curriculum called Beliefs Limiting Authentic Cultural Knowledge. The acronym for that is BLAC.
Wow.
at the front of the book, it says, beliefs are more powerful than facts. And you see it in our system today.
I saw January 6th.
There it is. There you say no more.
That's good, though, because when you believe something enough, you have to take action.
Yeah. So it depends how you use it. That's right. Because it's software. Your belief system is software, and it's designed for a purpose. And so once you put that software in, any other information that is not in line with the software, it gets dismissed because you've already put it in there. And so most people are only able to hold one piece of software at a time. There's a few, though, that are able to they're able to disassociate themselves from the software that they're currently working with, just to objectively entertain a different form of thought, like the discussion we're having. You are clearly understanding the racial identity mindset. I haven't asked you how you racially identify, but I'm sure you have, on some level, participated in a racial identification. But in our conversation, I can tell you're able to disassociate yourself for a minute and just think critically, think objectively about, what if? Not everybody's wired to do that.
I'm sure you know this, but just for the audience who may not know this, what is your thoughts on the three-fifths compromise? And I was talking to someone about this on Saturday, and it's kind of sad. Where someone like you and I, and this is still in law, by the way, mm-hmm. the three-fifths compromise mm-hmm. is still in law,
yes.
where Congress every 4 years or so has to kind of vote against it
right.
to make sure that it's not enacted, but it's still on the books. Mm-hmm. But basically, as a male, you and I would be legally considered as just three-fifths of a person.
Right.
A child is one-fifth. If a child looks like us, they're one-fifth. And if a woman looks like us, they're two-fifths.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, if someone is murdered, if someone is kidnapped, et cetera, it's viewed as that property that belongs to the United States government
mm-hmm.
was damaged, but not actually viewed as that life, that human being life was taken, or that human being life mm-hmm. was raped or ill-gotten.
Mm-hmm.
What is your thought on that, or perspective, or how could we help the audience understand what that does to us?
Well, in 2023, for a law like that to still be a force to be addressed, really, for those who are willing to look at things in a reality-based format, really shows the insanity of where we are right now. One of the last presentations I did, there was a term that one of the participants came up with, and he called it an irrational reality. So any policies based on race is irrational. It is distorted, and it is damaging. It's harmful. It's traumatic. The concept of three-fifths. If you're a human being and someone tells you you're three-fifths and you internalize that, think about what that does to you, how you see yourself. Think about what that does to how you see other people. Which when you said the analogy of the oppressor giving you the chain and the key, which is what we do. We've taken that ideology, that oppressive ideology, and we're continuing the Europeans' thought system about who we are and putting it in policy, putting it in law, putting it in health medical procedures. It's insane. And people are participating in it. Take racial gerrymandering.
Yeah.
Racial gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. When has that ever worked out for us? But we continue to do it, both the Republicans and the Democrats participate in this practice of racial gerrymandering. And it doesn't matter which political affiliation you're with, if you have this skin color, it's not going to work out for you. And so here's the insanity. We have people on the right, on the right, that have melanin, that have a different view than the people on the left that have melanin. But here's the idiocy of it. All of us who have melanin are not benefiting from racial gerrymandering.
No.
But we're arguing with each other about it.
For the audience, could you tell them, for those who may not know, can you tell them what gerrymandering is and how it plays a role in districts and things like that?
I can't give like the expert definition of it. What I can say is that it is when the political party gets together and zones these states, arranges these states that best achieves their voting goals.
Yeah.
And so they'll gerrymander by race in order to weed the or to dilute the voting power of the black racial demographic. That's the primary reason for it. And racial gerrymandering actually is illegal now, but it is still happening.
Still happens.
It's still occurring. Just like redlining is illegal, but it's still occurring because you can change policy, but if you don't change belief, it doesn't matter. You're just changing words.
Changing clothes.
You're just changing clothes. You didn't change the way you think. And so even when you try to do right, so like right now, the Supreme Court just knocked down, was it North Carolina's?
Yes.
North Carolina's gerrymandering.
Yep.
And now North Carolina is refusing to do what the Supreme Court says.
Yeah.
They're refusing to give the black racial demographic there two black zones, voting zones.
Yeah.
They're refusing to do it. They're refusing to do it. That's how entrenched this belief system is.
Yeah.
And so it's just amazing how the ideology divides even among people who have the same characteristics.
Yeah, it could be the same political party, like you said, mm-hmm. and they look at it different. And so I used to live in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I used to work for a congressman in our district that I worked for. It was District 12.
Mm-hmm.
It was very gerrymandered.
Mm-hmm.
And every single year, it just got smaller and smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of in the audience who maybe don't know, it goes to take a step further for gerrymandering. It lowers the voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is when it's time for a particular area to receive funding, they say, oh, well, you know, it's so weird. They say, oh, well, that target of people don't vote, right? But it's been gerrymandered to where it can't. So just as a quick example, in Greensboro, Greensboro has like seven colleges in it. And so what they would do is they say, well, if you don't have an address that you live in and you're a college student, if you have a college student, you can't vote. But if you live there and you live off campus and you've been living there for about a year and a half, you can vote. So, but if you're a student and you spend 9 or 10 months of the year there, you can't vote. So what they would do is for the district of the city, they would kind of gerrymander or slither through different parts of the county to say, this is good for voting. This is not good for voting. This is good for that party. This is not good for that party. And it just kills the funding they can receive from the government. And it kills housing and also kills housing values, too, in the long term.
Yeah, it does not work out for us.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the primary motivations for my being on the board of the Indy Black Chamber of Commerce. Because economics is really our most effective way out of this racial oppression that we're experiencing. Where I challenge the Black Chamber, however, is that we have to change our racial thinking. We have internalized what this black identity is. And so across the country, you'll see any place that has a Black Chamber of Commerce, you're going to see the same behaviors, the same challenges, and the same level of unsupport and lack of respect by its surrounding community. Because that's race ideology. So, from a subconscious perspective, black is of least value. And people know that.
Subconsciously, whenever I hear the word black, I hear lack.
Lack.
You can't spell black without lack. Mm-hmm. And that every time I hear that, that's what my mind goes to.
Exactly. And so we operate from a racial identity, from the racial identity of black. We operate from a we need others to help us mm-hmm. perspective. We need you to give us these set-asides or these special considerations. But there's a guy that I that motivated me, inspires me in my work to do this by the name of Dr. Claude Anderson.
Awesome.
Who wrote the book Powernomics.
I got that book at home.
He's got the recipe for a successful community right there in that book. I mean, it's not rocket science. Any successful cultural group uses these principles. Here's where, and with no disrespect to Dr. Claude Anderson, here's where the weakness or the flaw in his economic strategy is. Everything that book is asking or telling us to do cannot be done from a racial identity. One of the primary components of his strategy is the dollar in our community should circulate 8 to 12 times. So you probably know this, how long the dollar stays in our community.
Yeah, I think it's less than one.
It's 6 hours at best.
Yeah.
And if you think of yourself and anybody who's listening, think through the course of a week, how much of your economic interaction is with people that look like you. Think about it. From your school to your grocery shopping.
Coffee shops.
Any of your business interactions. How much of it is with people that look like you? Because statistically speaking, not much. So, how can you be an effective community? How can you even be asked to be respected when you don't even respect yourself economically? So the Indy Black Chamber of Commerce is about networking and working together and building support. But we have an internal software that says anything with black is lack. Their ice is colder. I'm going over there. Even when we consciously say, let's buy black, we don't buy black. Mm-mm. And we've been saying buy black for a long time. Mm-hmm. But nothing's changed. We don't support black because of our subconscious hardwiring. And we still do amongst each other the art of colorism, which is we value each other. We put each other on this hierarchy based on our skin tone.
Yep.
If you're lighter or darker than me, subconsciously, I associate the colonial Europeans' value of you based on your skin tone. We do it to ourselves.
Yep.
And we're not aware of that. So we're carrying our own mental shackles. And until we change that, we're just stirring the sauce around. But we are actually participating in maintaining this racial status quo. We're contributing to our own lack and staying at the bottom. The best thing you can tell a person who identifies as white is that you identify as black. That's the most security, comforting.
It's like it's working.
That's what they want, because now they know where to put you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've probably experienced this. You probably dressed up really nice and you probably had, you know, a nice presentation or some good quality stuff. And someone who identified as white was mildly impressed or shocked that, you know, expressed some statement of, wow, that was really, you know. That's amazing what you did. I mean, they were really shocked. Not like it was a compliment, like, hey, man, good job. But like, wow.
You can spell.
And they don't mean any harm by it.
No. That's their programming.
That's their program.
That's what they were given.
Mm-hmm. That's what they were giving. So when you want to make a person who identifies as white uncomfortable, which this is what I do, I don't do it for that purpose, but it does make them uncomfortable. I tell them that I'm not black.
So, wait a second. What are you?
Exactly. And it also makes people who identify as black uncomfortable, because they're looking at me like, this guy? He's a mental health counselor?
Self-diagnosed.
But don't you, look at him. He is. I reject the Europeans' label of oppression. Once I educated myself on what race was, I said, oh, that label was not who we were.
No.
It began with Negro. Negro is the Spanish word for black. And the idiocy is, even here in 2023, we have people in our community who some want to be called black and some want to be called Negro. But it's the same word.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Wow. I didn't know that people still want to be called Negro.
Some people still want to be called Negro.
Well,
some people still want to be called black. Some people want to be called African American. We don't even agree on who we are.
That's right. I thought you were going to say colored for a second.
Oh, well, that'll creep back in. That's going to creep back in.
Oh, I've heard that. People of color, yes.
People of color.
There you go. Yeah.
People, and then I always ask when that comes up, is white a color?
It's the absence of.
But is it a color?
Yeah.
Because people aren't on the same page about that either. Mm. It's in the crayon box.
It is in the crayon box.
Right? If I say, what color is this keyboard?
Yeah.
They're not going to say, well, that keyboard is the absence of color. They're going to say, it's white.
It's white, yeah, yeah.
So just that type of thinking should let you know the idiocy of this ideology.
Kind of to go a little deeper into that. So you also hear minorities, right? Mm-hmm. Minority. Yes. And then, of course, but minority also includes a woman,
mm-hmm.
a Caucasian woman could be a minority.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that person could qualify for the same.
Yeah. Well, it's all word games.
Yeah.
It's all word games. And, you know, when you're talking about, first of all, you're talking about America. So in America, you're either full American or you're not.
Mm.
You can't be 3/5 of an American. You're either 100% American or you're not. So that means you can't be a majority American or a minority American.
That's true.
You can have a majority opinion. You can have a majority preference. You know, things can be a majority. People can't. If you're an American and you believe in the philosophy of the Constitution, then we're all a majority because we're Americans.
We're all the same, technically.
But when we adopt based on this divisive ideology of race, now we internalize, well, I'm just a minority, so I should be just happy just that I'm sitting at the table. I'm not going to say much, but I'm here. That's minority thinking. You know, when you're talking about commerce, business is business. You know, this thing about black business. Business is business. It's business.
But business is a reflection of someone's identity.
Business is a reflection. Exactly. That's very personal reflection. And if you look at the state of quote-unquote black business, that really should tell you how we see ourselves, because the state of black business is in dismal array. We are in a downward trajectory. It's predicted that by the year 2053, the average wealth per black family will be $0. Not an opinion, fact.
That is horrible.
Because, number one, one of the primary reasons of that is the black racial demographic is not participating in its own economic support. We're still spending our money out. I don't want reparations right now because our mindset's not ready for reparations.
It will go back out.
It'll be gone the next day. And then then it's done, because they'll be saying, well, we gave you your money and you're still in the same boat. It's like a person who's been broke all their life and they win the lottery. You've heard the story, right?
Yeah.
And typically what happens to the average lottery winner over 5 years?
They're broke.
They're broke again because their financial circumstances change, but their mindset about finances stayed the same. They were still in a poverty, lack, black mindset.
That was the ideology.
It's the ideology.
Yeah, that is good. Sir, as we wrap up for today, are there things you might want the audience to do, maybe to follow you on social media or to attend your next workshop?
So one of the initiatives that I'm really proud to be a part of is called the Reimagining Race Initiative. And it is, I've been appointed to this position by a group called the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee. Okay. Very, 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 just a great group. And they're all things Indianapolis, and they want to see Indianapolis grow. And this Progress Committee has a subcommittee called the Race and Cultural Relations Leadership Network. And so through that subcommittee, I'm doing this Reimagining Race Initiative. And we're hosting a series of community forums to develop new leaders in this new thought paradigm of racial deconstruction to start changing the pattern of these racial disparities. It's not training. We're not doing training. This is an action plan. And the action begins once. There's a quote by Gil Scott-Heron, and he wrote this. It's one of his pieces he wrote. The revolution will not be televised. And the reason behind him writing that is he states that the first revolution begins in the mind. And because it begins in the mind, it will not be televised. But nothing happens without that first revolution. And what we tend to do is we just want to go get on television and do these things that everybody sees without doing the work behind the curtain to say, before I get out there in public, let me address my thinking. And that's what this initiative does, is it teaches this new paradigm of thought, looking together a cohort of new leadership to start addressing the real tangible issues of racial disparities in education, in finance, in business, in loans, public health, safety. And most people still don't realize that in June of 2020, the Marion County City Council declared racism a public health crisis. That's serious. But because it's not like COVID, people don't really connect with it.
It's worse than COVID.
It's worse than COVID. So I encourage everybody to get the Declaration Proposal 182 that lists all of the major medical and psychological associations that are in support of this declaration, to include the Center for Disease Control, that are online on official declaration, so in support of racism being a public health crisis. And a public health crisis doesn't mean black public. It means public. It means everybody.
Yeah.
But people, even when I say it, I say it over and over and over. And for most people, it's this glaze that comes over their mind, their face. They just, well, what does that mean? Because they can't really see how it's impacting them, which is the genius of race. It's so normal, it's right in front of you, and you're not even aware that you're being harmed. As a matter of fact, you're participating in your own demise, beginning with identifying by a color. Once you identify by black or by white, you are part of the problem. So get on the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee website. You get the information. You can register there to be notified. I want you to attend these forums. The next forum is August the 19th. It's in collaboration with a great group of men that I'm working with. It's founded by Dr. Preston Adams of Amazing Grace Church. And it's called Men and Mental Health Movement. Men and Mental Health. Not black men and mental health.
Men.
Men and Mental Health. And they're hosting our third series in this forum to address the racial gap between service providers in mental health and the community.
Wow. That is awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to have that along with other ways to get in contact with you in the show notes so that people can also begin to put that three-step process together. Mr. George?
Man, great conversation, man.
Thank you, yeah. Sir. We will do this again.
All right.